You're listening to a Zone Radio podcast, zoneradio.co.za.
That brings the time to 12 minutes past four, and it is now time for this.
The IP Zone is brought to you by Spoor & Fisher, because every pioneer needs a partner.
At Spoor & Fisher, we understand the value of innovation and the sinister threats of your ideas being stolen.
Spoor & Fisher specializes in IP law. Our experienced team of specialists will do everything to protect what's yours.
When concept becomes reality, we're there to lock it down.
Create it. Own it.
Choose Spoor & Fisher to secure your intellectual property.
And with that, we launch the IP Zone. And he is a senior partner at Spoor & Fisher. He is also, he doesn't like me saying this, he is a law professor. He is our newsreader here at Zone Radio and also a presenter. He is John McKnight. And John, welcome. And it's a different set of circumstances now, because we're talking about something that is very, very dear to your heart, even as much as music. And it is intellectual property. So what I want you to do is just set the scene for us this afternoon. First, some background on Spoor & Fisher.
Sure.
Because they're one of the biggest law firms when it comes to intellectual property, and also what that term intellectual property encompasses.
Great. Well, good afternoon, Unicorn. Nice to see you again. Thank you for having me in on this side of the studio today. All right. Well, let me start with just a quick definition of what intellectual property is, because, you know, for me, it's a very interesting aspect of law. It's a very small corner of the legal platform on which we all stand. And basically what it is it's property law. But unlike a house or a car, which is tangible property, intellectual property begins its life between somebody's ears, right? So it's a thought, it's a creation. And so intellectual property law is the conduit by which these ideas become assets of the people who create those ideas, and they can be used in trade, in industry or agriculture. So that's generally the field of intellectual property law, and we're going to take a deep dive into that this afternoon. But just to talk about the firm quickly, firm is about just over 100 years old, and what we do, what's unusual about Spoor & Fisher is that we only do intellectual property.
Nothing else.
Nothing else. Mm. So if you get arrested at a roadblock, or if it's a divorce, unfortunately we can't help you. It's just intellectual property. So we look to recognize intellectual property when it's created in our clients. We look to protect it. We look to sort of get rights all around the world, and then we also help our clients sort of lever that and commercialize that intellectual property, because patents and trademarks and designs, which are what we're talking about today, are assets of individuals and assets of firms. They're taken very seriously, and their management is a big part of doing business today, and so we assist in that. And of course, while it's all very nice to have your own patent and to look to license it or to use it yourself, you also have to be aware in everything that you do that you're not infringing anybody else's intellectual property. So we spend a lot of time protecting our clients from infringing, or trying to get our clients to avoid from infringing other people's intellectual property. So we protect our clients' intellectual property, we respect the intellectual property of others, and we commercialize the assets that we create on that basis. So that's kind of what we do. So let's get back to what actual intellectual property is. So like I said earlier, it begins its life between somebody's ears, and it's property in every sense of the word. The only difference is that intellectual property is sometimes called intangible property rather than intellectual property, because a house or a car, you can touch, you can feel. Whereas an idea is exactly that. And until a patent attorney gets hold of it and turns it into a patent, or a trademark attorney puts it down on paper and puts it in at the trademarks office, an idea is just that. It's intangible. But it is property, just like a house or a car is property. Mm. And so this is the important thing about intellectual property. It's just like you can buy and sell your house or your car, you can buy and sell intellectual property. You can allow other people to use that intellectual property while you yourself remain the owner, just like you can lease a car or you can rent a house. You can lease intellectual property, and that's called licensing. The parallels actually go further than that, because unlike just like residential property, if you want to have the rights, if you want to stop people squatting into your house, you'll have to have paid your rates and taxes, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to be able to drive your car on the road, you'll have to have paid your annual license fees. And it's exactly the same with patents and designs and trademarks. There are annual maintenance fees that need to be paid. And unless you pay those, you lose your rights in this intellectual property. So it is property. But like I say, it just began its life between somebody's ears. So if you've ever done a course in business or whatever, and there was an IP segment to it, a short section on intellectual property, you might have heard the definition that intellectual property law protects the products of the intellect which are capable of commercial exploitation. That's a very legalese definition, but it's not particularly helpful. So what we're going to do now is we're going to look at intellectual property and we're going to sort of exemplify some of the main components of it. So in South Africa, in this beautiful country in which we're blessed to live, we have the big five in the game reserve, right? We have the big five species of mammals. And in intellectual property, we have the big five as well. There are other species of intellectual property, but the big five that we will be focusing on this afternoon and going forward in the IP zone is that intellectual property includes patents, registered designs, copyright, trademarks, and know-how or trade secrets. And so what we're going to do this afternoon is just going to do a quick sort of cover over all of them and see how they all mesh together and how you get protection in each of those different species. So the big five. So patents. Let's start with what I consider to be the most important. My trademark partners will beg to differ, but I'm a patent attorney, so that's where we're going to start. Patents protect ideas in industrially realizable form. So a patent can protect a new product, a new process, or a new use of a product. But basically what patents are, when you protect something by way of a patent, you are protecting a solution to a problem. Now, that problem can be anything from a more efficient way to catch mice to the latest generation of HIV pharmaceutical drugs and everything in between. So and how it basically works is that you think up a solution. And now, in order to get a patent, you have to be the first guy or person to have ever thought of that solution. The barrier to entry is quite high. You've got to be the first guy basically in the history of humanity to have thought of that. Because if anybody else has described that solution, be it on the other side of the world at a conference in Mongolia, your idea is said to be anticipated and you cannot get protection for it. So you have to be the first guy to think of it. So that's quite a high barrier. And how it would work is that if you're seized with a problem and you've solved that problem in a manner which is new, then you would take that concept to a patent attorney and you would explain the background, you'd explain the problem, and then you and your patent attorney would work together because you would have just invented a particular embodiment of a solution to that problem. But your patent attorney's job would be to expand that into a specification and to really give you a sphere of protection around a point of invention. That's kind of what we do. So you'll sit down with your patent attorney. He'll say, yes, it's an invention. It looks pretty good. This is how we're going to do it. And he puts together a document, which is called a patent specification, and it describes the problem that this invention will be addressing and why we haven't been able to solve it up until now. And then he'll put forward the solution that you've come up with, which is the invention. And then he'll set about putting out different examples of your invention, different embodiments of it. And then that patent application will end with a set of claims which defines your invention. And it's those set of claims which define the monopoly. That is what other people are not allowed to do. Because a patent is framed in the negative in the sense that it doesn't give you permission to put your invention into practice. It just gives you permission to stop others from practicing your invention. So think about if you were to invent, for example, a new pharmaceutical, you don't have the right to make and sell that pharmaceutical. You've got to go through the Medicines Control Council and prove that it's safe, and it's big drama and takes a long time. So a patent doesn't give you that right, but a patent does give you the right to stop your competitors from doing and copying you in terms of that technical solution. So a patent application or a patent specification which sets out your invention is a very important document because it fulfills two roles. It teaches everybody how to solve the problem. It gives a full disclosure of your invention, and it sets out the monopoly that other people are not allowed to do. So patent applications are not secret. They are available for everybody to read. Mm. And that's where the word patent comes from. It's a Latin word meaning open. And the other the use of the word patent in the English language is something is said to be patently obvious. Mm. It's clear on the face of it.
Yeah.
So letters patent are documents which are open. And we have these massive, massive databases where every patent which has ever been filed is available for public inspection. It's quite a database. So you could go in there and type golf ball, and all the patents on all golf balls over the years comes up, and you can see what these guys have been doing and how they've been trying to.
Which is part of the service you offer when somebody sits down with you, because you'll do a patent search to say, listen, you're barking up the wrong tree. Somebody already came up with this.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And if we can head them off in the past, then we can save them a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And because, I mean, the one thing we have to say is patenting is not for the faint-hearted. It's quite expensive. Mm. And there's a lot of hours of legal work involved in getting this patent document together. But not only that, patents are territorial, because what a patent actually is a deal between the government and the citizens, which says that, so a government is always looking, well, should always be looking to uplift the quality of life of its citizens. Mm. And it does that by solving problems, but it can't be seized with every single problem, right? So what it does is it offers a quid pro quo or a reward system, which says to the guys out there, listen, if you solve a problem which afflicts society, then in return, we're very grateful for you doing that. And in return, we'll give you a 20-year monopoly so that you can enjoy the fruits of your innovation. Mm. We will allow you to stop others from doing it. But that's a deal between you and the government, right? So if you want your patent in the U.S., you have to strike that deal with the U.S. government and the Australian government and the Japanese government. So it's a very fractured process to get protection all around the world. Mm. There's certainly no such thing as a global patent. Mm. It's a territorial right, and you have to engage with the authorities in each of the territories that you want. So to get a South African patent is one thing, but to get that patent in America is completely another, because your patent attorney will have to write to U.S. attorneys, and they'll have to file it with the U.S. authorities, and they'll have to comply with all the laws in the U.S., and they'll charge you $650 an hour for the privilege of doing it. Mm, so it's really not for the faint-hearted.
Yeah.
But it can be a very – well, it's I'll come back to this a number of times, but it is an asset. Like a house or a car is worth money, intellectual property is an asset. So it's worth having, because it can be monetized and it can be levered to create revenue streams.
I've got a question that come up here. I'm going to summarize it.
Yeah,
it basically boils down to this. If you come up with an idea, but you need to like have a prototype made and that kind of thing – there's a risk that your idea could be stolen by somebody who's making the prototype or has carried it to the is there any kind of short-term protection for somebody who's got an idea? So I come up with an idea. I need to sort of massage it a little bit and first of all, see if a prototype is workable, all that kind of good stuff, before I actually go down that road of patenting the thing.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of interim or short-term protection?
So as you might imagine, a lot of people find themselves in that unenviable situation where they need to involve other third parties for proof of concept or whatever. So there are two choices that an inventor faces at that point in his journey. The first is that he can brief a patent attorney to file a patent application on what he knows up to that point. Because once your patent application is on file with the patent office, you can really go bananas and tell everybody, but you will have secured what's called a priority date. So there's that. The other option that is available to an inventor at that point in time is to say to whoever he's going to do the work for him, listen, what I'm about to show you is top secret. It's confidential. So you're not allowed to tell anybody else about it. And you need to sign what's called a non-disclosure agreement or a secrecy agreement. And again, your attorney, your patent attorney, will be able to supply you with one of those, and both of you sign it. And then that basically means that whatever you show this guy who's building the prototype or assisting you in whatever, that any such disclosure is A, not made available to the public, and B, even if he does run away and trial file his own patent application or sell the idea, such a disclosure is unlawful, because he's contracted with you to keep it secret.
Okay.
So if he breaks that, then it doesn't impact your application down the line, and it's yours.
Yeah. Okay, so there we go. I hope that answered the question.
So any other questions, keep them piling in, because I'm very happy to answer. Right. So we're
going to perfect answers. Thank you.
There we go. That's great. Right. Okay. So we'll circle back to patents because, like I said, patents are a big thing for me. But basically, if there's one takeaway from this afternoon, is that a patent protects a solution to a problem. So it's technical in nature.
Mm.
Incidentally, your patent attorney will have a technical degree, right? He's a lawyer in the sense that he's passed his bar exam and he's got his law degree and all the rest of it. But over and above that, he's got a technical degree. So a lot of the guys in my firm are engineers. They are electrical engineers who deal with inventions relating to cell phones and all good things like that, mechanical engineers who deal with buildings and anything mechanical. I'm a chemist, so I deal with paints and pharmaceuticals and things like that. We've got biochemists who deal with these new DNA questions and recombinant inventions and things like that. So your patent attorney will have a skill set, and you will be directed to the guy who's most qualified to deal with your particular invention based on the subject matter of your invention. So, right. Okay, so that's patents. They protect solutions to an invention, and they are technical in nature. Another species of intellectual property that I just want to quickly touch on is registered designs. Now, registered designs protect the outward appearance of industrially produced articles. So you might think, well, why is that important? So let's just talk about kettles for a moment. Okay, so we all have a kettle, right? I mean, it's a very important part of making a cup of coffee. But all kettles are the same thing. They're a container. They've got a heating element. You plug it in, you put water in it, and it heats water. Now, you know, you can get an entry-level kettle from, any one of the shops just across the road in the malls here for $300, and it's going to heat your water. So why on earth would you pay 2,500 rand for a Smeg kettle which does exactly the same thing? And the answer is, that Smeg kettle looks cool, well, at least in some people's eyes, right? Including my lovely wife, which is why we have one. So that is the value of a design, right? I mean, from a purely utilitarian point of view, it does the same thing as an entry-level kettle, but it just looks that much cooler in your kitchen. And I agree. I really like a Smeg kettle. I mean, it looks great. So and that's why you can load a premium, because of the aesthetics. Now, you think about that when it comes to kettles, but actually designs are everywhere. They're everything from the shape of your shampoo bottle to the shape of your phone to the shape of certain parts on your car, your bonnet, your rearview mirror. All of these things, if you'll forgive the pun, shape your buying decision, so they have value. So designs protect the outward appearance of industrially produced articles, and There's a lot of value to that. So you can imagine every shampoo bottle, every bar of soap is the subject of a registered design. You don't want your competitors trying to have their products look like yours so that they get bought by accident. Then we have trademarks. Now, trademarks, my learned colleagues in the firm will argue that trademarks are much bigger than patents because they're just so much more common, because almost everything you know, looking around me in the studio now, I see multiple trademarks. I see Samsung on my monitor, I see Zone Radio and our logo emblazoned everywhere. I see Spoor and Fisher. I see my watch, my phone. So these are all badges of distinction which owners apply to their product. And so that influences the purchase of that product, right? So a good example would be the difference between Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Both are carbonated cocoa-flavored beverages. But if you went into a cafe and said, can I have a cocoa-flavored carbonated beverage, you'd just be laughed at, and rightly so, because what you do is you go to the fridge and you reach for one of those two drinks on the basis of what it's called and what it looks like, its packaging and its get-up. So I'm a guy who likes a Coke, so I will go and I'll grab the red can because I had one yesterday, it was brilliant, and I want that exact same experience again today. So that is why a trademark is so important, because they are badges of origin. They serve to identify your product and distinguish them from those of your competitors, right? So we want people to listen to Zone Radio, and so that's why we have the colors and the name Zone Radio. And so people come back because they like what they hear. They don't listen to – they don't start listening to a competitor by mistake. So because Zone Radio is a badge of distinction within the space of radio stations. And so trademarks, of course, are ubiquitous. They're everywhere, from the cars you drive to the phones you use to the TVs you watch to the clothes you wear. And it's big, big money. Mm. And we can talk about trademark infringement, which is where somebody has a different mark, but it's very, very close to the original mark. And then there's counterfeiting, which is the slavish use of a mark, but on a product that hasn't been made in the original manufacturer's facilities. And that's counterfeiting versus trademark infringement. And all of that is really big business. Then the one, probably the biggest one, although the one that doesn't get the most attention, is copyright. So copyright protects artistic or literary works. And there's no merit required, right? So if I just do a scribble on a piece of paper, that's a work of art, and I can stop somebody copying it technically, okay? You can't have a merit-based inquiry as to whether copyright protection exists or not, because can you imagine, you know, coming before a judge and the Beatles would be denied copyright because the judge was more of a kind of Rolling Stones guy.
Yeah.
You didn't think the Beatles had any artistic merit.
Yeah.
So you can't introduce that subjectivity in it. But basically they protect songs and poems and movies and anything sort of artistic or literary. So a song, for example, will have multiple layers of copyright on it. It'll be the musical score, A flat followed by B. Mm. It'll be the lyrics, you know, on a bright and sunny day, da-da-da. And then there'll be the performance, which is the actual artistic performance. And everybody who's involved in each of those layers will get a little bit of the royalties that come from when that song is played on the radio or the if somebody buys the record. Everybody gets a little bit of cut because of their contribution to copyright. So copyright is everywhere, right? But the big difference between copyright and patents, registered designs, and trademarks is that you don't get a patent or a design or a trademark unless you wander down to the patent office or the trademarks office, fill out the form, pay your money, and put your paperwork in, okay? You don't have to do that with copyright. Copyright just exists upon creation of the work. Now, that's a good thing and a bad thing because, you know, you have this incredible body of work that just gets getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But the trouble with that is that when it comes to enforcing copyright, if you want to enforce a patent or a trademark, it's easy. You just whip out your certificate that you got from the patent office. It says, John got this patent on this day. That's the end of the story about me actually proving I have rights.
Yeah.
But it's a lot more difficult than copyright because you have to prove that you were that you created the work, when you created the work, that it was original and new, et cetera, et cetera. So copyright is very, very common. But we don't hear a lot about copyright battles because they tend to be quite expensive because they're very fact-based inquiries about who did what on what day, and all of those allegations have to be proved. So the last
before you go any further, and maybe you're still getting there. So we've spoken about, you know, music performance and that type of stuff, and we've spoken about trademarks. Somewhere in between that, or maybe beyond that, is a thing like photography and paintings.
Yeah.
Where do they fall in? Do they fall into trademark? Do they fall into copyright? Do they fall into a separate category?
So photography and paintings are all protected by copyright.
Okay.
So paintings are definitely a work of art.
Yeah.
But a photograph is a very interesting one because, you know, when you take the family down and have all of you have your picture taken in a studio, who owns the copyright in that? Is it you? Because you're the guy in the photo.
Mm.
You just paid the wombat behind the camera to push the button.
Mm.
But so there's all laws about who owns that work, right?
Mm.
Who's responsible for its creation, et cetera, et cetera. But anything artistic, any paintings, visual, broadcasting, television broadcasting, cinematographic films, they are all copyright protected. So what's interesting is that bands trademark their name. And it's you can often tell when a band is about to tour South Africa because we'll get instructions to file the trademark for Bruce Springsteen or Aha or something. Because they wouldn't normally have copyrighted trademarked them in South Africa, but they're coming. They're going to be selling a lot of merch. They don't want counterfeiters outside the venues. They want to be able to shut them down quickly. So they quickly get their trademark before they come to the country. So we get a little bit of a heads up when somebody so the last of the five species that I just wanted to talk to is something called know-how, or often called trade secrets. And this is an unregistered body of confidential proprietary knowledge developed over time, which results in an optimized product or process. It usually resides with key personnel and is only of value whilst confidential. So what's a good example of know-how? The KFC recipe, right?
Mm.
Or even the recipe for Coke.
Mm.
Okay, these are huge value secrets. Nobody's been able to crack them, and they are kept secret by the companies. Okay. And those are the stratospheric examples of the value of confidential information. But it really trickles down to a whole bunch of things. So if you're a salesman and you sell paper, you sell reams of paper, you'll have a little black book and you'll know that in January every year you sell 5 reams of paper to Philip, and he's got 3 kids and one is writing matric. So in your little black book, you know, you on the 1st of January you call Philip, you say, "Hey buddy, how's it going? How are the kids? I understand Mark is doing matric this year." "Yeah, hope that goes well. Are you still up for your paper? Mark might need a little bit more because he's going to be doing some printing this year." 5 reams, 6 reams, just that kind of knowledge, right? That you know, it's in your head. That is valuable because it's selling paper, right?
Mm.
It's allowing you, it's facilitating you, it's optimizing your paper sales. And so that kind of information, a lot of people don't realize that they actually have it, but it's of extreme value to any business, right? And it can be just like who likes what in terms of your customer database, but it can also be things like if you're manufacturing and you are mixing paint or something like that and it starts raining, then you realize in your shed that if you don't want the paint to separate out, you've got to just up the rotation speed of the mixers or something to compensate for the cooler temperature. It's that kind of intimate knowledge of your business, which is baked into the business, but not everybody knows it.
Mm.
And that's got huge value, and that is recognized within intellectual property. So when you sell your business, when you sell your paint business, the buyer will want to know.
And they have a right to have it.
And they have a right to have it, right? So they will ask of you what's called the skills transfer, whereby you tell them all of the trade secrets around the business. And obviously there's a lot of secrecy around that. So that when you sell your business, a buyer who's got half a brain cell will insist that you are bound by confidentiality so that you can't go tell anybody else those secrets or even practice them yourself if you've fully divested of the business. So that's baked in value into a business, is trade secrets or confidential information. So that's the fifth. There are other smaller species of intellectual property. Probably the next biggest one is something called a plant breeder's right, whereby if you selectively breed 2 plants together and you arrive at a new variety, but you haven't tinkered with the DNA, you've just done clever breeding, and you can get a blue rose or a seedless watermelon or something like that. If you can prove that this new variety that you've selectively bred is durable, uniform, and stable, then you can get what's called a plant breeder's right, which allows you to only sell that variety. And so when you go to a nursery or a garden store, or even when you go and buy oranges in the shop, you'll see that a lot of them have got little stickers on them, and they've got a variety name. And that's because they are subject to a plant breeder's right. And they are often very popular because of this new thing, this new characteristic which you've been able to introduce to the market.
It's a complex topic.
It is. I think it's complex at first brush, but when you get into it, the basic concept behind it is quite simple, and it always steps off from the point of a recognition of creation and individual creation, a recognition of the human spirit of entrepreneurship and innovation, and a legal framework that is designed to protect that and encourage that. That lies at the heart of intellectual property.
Well, if these are the broad brushstrokes, I'm really looking forward to getting into the detail down the line, because we're going to be doing these once a month.
That's,
and we're going to break some of these things down into more detail. But I think the one thing that people need to listen out for, and probably when they're asking questions, is that because of our lack of understanding of how complex this law really is, we are susceptible to breaching.
Yes, or being exploited.
Or being exploited. So you could take somebody's photograph off the internet and put it on your Facebook post, and that could get you into a lot of hot water, depending on who that photograph belongs to. It may just belong to Joe Soap over there, doesn't really care, but it could be a company's thing.
Yeah.
The Nike logo, for argument's sake, you know, and you can get yourself into big trouble.
Then you are at the mercy of the owner of that piece of intellectual property, because it's their prerogative as to how they want to treat you.
Yeah.
And you get very varying sort of reactions to people taking intellectual property. Some people say, hey, man, you know, imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. Of course you can use it. That's fine. And other people who just go bananas and lose their minds and demand hugely unreasonable sums of money for the smallest use of their intellectual property. So you don't know what you're up against.
I think an example of that is we started out the show with My Sweet Lord by George Harrison.
Right.
And there was a massive copyright suit about that because the chiffons felt that he had kind of plagiarized or imitated.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up having to pay a large sum of money to them. But the reality was that he said he, even the judge said that it was done unconsciously. It wasn't like he did it on purpose.
Mm.
All right? It just came across that way. It was just the way it sounded. But yet he had to foot the bill. So sometimes we can be caught out. And we did. We weren't. There was no intent.
Yeah, there was no malice or anything like that.
Mm.
And unfortunately, one of the mantras in intellectual property law is that ignorance is no defense.
Yeah.
So it's out there, guys, and you are deemed to be aware of it.
And the things that we're going to be unpacking going forward and start to come into play now and come into play for everybody is this beast called AI.
Mm.
We haven't yet, you know, scratch the surface of all of that. So I'm really looking forward to the conversations that we're going to have going forward. And certainly have folks that you are going to get your questions lined up.
Yeah, yeah.
And John can answer them. Is there anything else, John, before we wrap up the first session?
Have we got 2 more minutes?
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right, let's just talk about how common intellectual property is. And when you go to the shop, almost every product on the shelf has intellectual property behind it. So if you take a simple bottle of Gaviscon, the bottle cap will have a tamper indicator on it so that when you open it, you know, you'll be able to see that it's got frangible joints. That bottle cap has been designed to show that it's been opened. There's a patent. The formulation of Gaviscon, I can tell you now, it's patented.
Mm.
There's know-how into how they made it in the factory. There is the shape of the bottle can often be protected by registered design if the bottle has got a unique shape. Gaviscon Advanced, the logo, the colors, these are all subjects of registered trademarks. And then the label design, the picture on the label, and the instruction pamphlet that comes with it, those are all literary works. They don't have to be particularly meritorious, but they're all protectable by copyright. So a simple bottle of Gaviscon embodies and exemplifies all 5 of the big 5 species of intellectual property that we spoke about today.
And there's so many of those on the shelf.
And there's the shelf is full of, so it's everywhere.
A question, John. If I commission an artist for a reasonable hand-drawn facsimile of a copyrighted image, would that breach the original copyright?
Yes. Yes is the answer.
Mm.
And there's a second phase to that question is when you ask somebody to create a work from you, the person who creates the work is the owner of the copyright, not you. Just because you paid him doesn't mean that you own the copyright. So you need to have an agreement with anybody that you get to take a picture or paint a picture that the copyright owns with you, the commissioner, not the artist.
And if you don't do that, you can be caught short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The best you can argue is that you've got a small license to use the work, but the copyright remains with the artist.
All right. So don't do that. You know, can't do that. All right. Does that kind of set? I think that sets the stage, folks. What do you think? I think that John has done a great job of unpacking what it is.
Mm.
We all know about criminal. We all know about when you get your deeds and all that kind of
your
good
conveyancing.
Stuff. Conveyancing. We all know about those things.
Yeah.
But this is a segment of the law that not too many people come into contact with on a daily basis, yet they run the risk of ending up on the wrong side of it.
Yeah, it's a very esoteric part of law. It's not for the uninitiated, and so I really must emphasize that they mustn't be afraid of picking up the phone and speaking to an attorney. Not necessarily Spoor and Fisher. Any IP attorney understands that they're working in a very complex area of law, and they will give their time to explain the concepts to. So, if you have an idea, if you have something, call an attorney. Ask for just a 30-minute consultation. They're not going to bill you for that.
Mm.
And then at least you'll be in a position, you'll be in possession of all the facts that are so important to this thing that you've created.
It's fascinating. It really is fascinating. John, thank you.
Great stuff. We'll see you in a month for the next
Yes.
IP Zone.
Yeah, we'll do that in a month's time. We'll make sure that people are made aware of when it is coming up, and you can listen in. And, of course, you can catch John on or tomorrow.
Tomorrow morning, yes, and then Friday evening as well.
And then Friday evening. man of many talents. John, thanks so much for coming in this afternoon and for explaining all that to us. It really is appreciated.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
The IP Zone was brought to you by Spoor & Fisher, because every pioneer needs a partner. Visit spoor.com.
You are a leader, a visionary. You embrace technology to develop cutting-edge solutions. You are original and innovative. You imagine. Trailblazing is often a lonely path, but we see the extraordinary in what you do. When it comes to understanding and protecting your intellectual property, your journey is our journey. Visit our website at spoor.com and discover how we can protect what is uniquely yours. Spoor & Fisher. Create it. Own it.